This is Living Real Radio, real issues in real time with your host, John Angotti, Greg Walton, and Julianne Staley. Living Real Radio is sponsored by Closets by Design. Imagine your home totally organized by Closets by Design. Call them today to schedule your appointment at 615-261-8700. That's 615-261-8700.
Good morning. Welcome to Living Real Radio. I'm your host, John Angotti. It's Buying Solo today down in New Orleans at the National Pastoral Musicians Conference. And we welcome you all to New Orleans this great Sunday morning. And today's guest is Amanda Bruce. And Amanda is with the NPM Association. And what exactly is your title, Amanda?
So my title is Assistant Director of Marketing and Communications for NPM, which is also known as the National Association of Pastoral Musicians.
Right. And so we're all part of this organization. And what is the purpose of this organization within the Catholic Church?
Right. So within the Catholic Church, we really represent those who help pastoral ministry flourish. So many of us are pastoral musicians. Some of us are in leaders in religious life, are in religious lives themselves. Some of us are clergy. But primarily, we focus on supporting those who support the music in the Catholic Church.
And how long has NPM been around?
Oh, my gosh. I want to say about 44 years. Yeah, 1978, like I do believe, is the first year.
Mm-hmm. And so this conference is, last year we missed this conference. And the fact that we're gathering today, I think, or this week, has been just, that's the success in my book. You know, that even though it's smaller, people are afraid, maybe from COVID. But you all have done a great job of gathering us, so I want
thank
to give you big kudos
thank you.
About that.
Well, thank you. Yeah, if for those of you who are listening and aren't here with us, we're having what's called a hybrid convention, which means that some people are attending in person and some are at home. And so some things are being live streamed from the hotel back to virtual attendees and vice versa. Some things that are Zoom webinars with people who are presenting from afar are being live streamed into the hotel. So we're trying to kind of bridge that gap this year between those who maybe choose not to come out due to COVID, which is totally acceptable and understandable, or maybe can't afford, to be honest, to travel right now.
Yeah.
This gives them a great opportunity to still stay connected.
Yeah. You know, within the church, there's different publishers and things of that nature within the church. But what I find with NPM, it's the place where all the music people can gather on this common ground and meet.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like the safe place for all of us to come. And over the years, I think I've been coming since, I think 1995 might have been.
Okay.
Were you born then?
I was born then.
Okay. Yeah. Usually they give me a hard time on the show because I have a couple other co-hosts. They always give me a hard time about being the old guy. You know. But anyway, nevertheless. The over the years, just what this conference has done for me and how much I've seen other Catholic musicians in formation and resources and things of that nature. Being everything being changing, what do you see NPM's, where are we going to be, you know, now in this after COVID, those kind of things? Where do you think NPM can help the pastoral musician?
Yeah, that's a great question. The truth is, as pastoral musicians and pastoral ministers, anyone in the church, I would say almost anyone in any situation right now are saying, well, when we go back to normal or whatever the new normal is what we're saying, right? I think that ministry radically changed in the last year and a half. Many of us, not all of us, but many of us were not live streaming. Many of us just connected with people on a normal one-on-one basis. And now in the last year, many of us had to become live streaming experts, podcast producers, making digital worship aids, making sure that all of our copyright licenses were up to date, which we were doing before. But then there's this streaming aspect. There was this entire level of knowledge that we as pastoral musicians have to know. And so I do think that as we go forward, I do think at NPM we're going to seek to support more of the modern challenges, not just musically, although that's, of course, our flagship, that's our focus. There is this level of knowledge and ministry that has now evolved, I think, in a much larger part of the Catholic Church that we have to support. So I see us hopefully in the future supporting with more virtual offerings, with more technological offerings, with things that maybe meet people where they are. Because our ministry is just, I think that so many facets of what we thought we could guarantee have changed. I mean, John, I mean, I don't know about you, but we didn't use hymnals in the last year or so.
I know.
Right?
Well, I just had this question with Scott Crandall from OCP about, you know, where do we think hymnals are going to be,
right?
You know?
Yeah.
And just this whole paper world that seems to be going away. But I think, you know, some people want books. Some people, you know, is it a necessity?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. It's hard to tell what'll come from all that.
I don't know either, but I will say this. I didn't question it until COVID, at least not to the level that I have now. And now I just, it's like, oh my gosh, we couldn't have them, so we had to adapt what's right for our parish, what's right for ministry. So yeah, uh-huh. I think it raised questions that maybe a lot of us never questioned, never thought about.
Yeah. Why do people need NPM?
Oh, I mean, maybe this is a personal bias in my response, but NPM has always been the place where I feel the most related to. John, our ministry and our jobs as pastoral ministers, music directors, we, in some ways, I think, are not understood by so many people. We make so many sacrifices for the sake of ministry. We miss most weekends. We miss Christmas. We miss Thanksgiving in a lot of places. We miss New Year's. We miss Easter. We miss so many Hallmark moments because we're ministering. And that comes us with a set of challenges to be understood, to be supported in that way. And while our friends and family and spouses do, there's something about coming to an event and connecting to an association like NPM that helps me feel related to in the unique challenges, not just, of course, weekends and whatnot, but the unique challenges that come in our ministry. It's a unique job. It's a unique job. It's a unique field.
Yeah, you know, I'd say all organizations need a type of NPM.
Yeah.
You know, like a, you know, the place where you can go and grab your resources and get your help. And,
right.
You know, it's like a one-stop shop for everybody when it needs assistance or all that kind of stuff, you know. And then in conglomeration and keeping everybody playing nice, you know, within the realm of the economics of church, you know, which is a side that I don't think a lot of people see the economic side of what happens in order to make Sunday happen.
I think a lot of people have no idea.
Yeah. And, you know, what goes on with selecting music and, you know, from the music director's position of juggling which songs are going to be best, knowing your community, knowing that you have to meet the liturgical, the musical, and the pastoral senses of what the music can do for your assembly. So if a music director doesn't have anywhere to go or to look, he can always look to come to NPM for advice, because there's the website that has all that for training and things of that nature. Well, what about you? How'd you get started in all this?
Well, so my mom is also a pastoral musician. She's been a pastoral musician since I was in utero, essentially, and she did it full time for most of my life. And I grew up on the organ bench next to her. I mean, I was in charge of turning her pages when she was playing the organ. My goodness, the trust she had in me, because if someone had to turn my pages when I, you know, when they were seven, I'm not sure if I would trust them. But anyways, she always, if she were here, she'd tell you, she didn't die. It sounds like she died, but she's not here in New Orleans with me. But if she were here, she would say that she trained me because I had an interest in organ, which is totally true. She trained me so that I could be a substitute organist for her. And then I went and got my own job and was of no help. So I just started to really find a home in pastoral music. So at 10, I started playing Mass at our Catholic school. I was already there. And to be honest, I felt fidgety at Mass. I wanted to participate. I wanted to be a part of it. So at 10, I started to just play a couple hymns for our weekly Catholic school Mass. At 14, I got my first church job. And I've had a church job ever since. Well, ever since until July 1st when I became full-time with NPM. But up until then, it was 18 years of full-time music ministry.
We have similar paths because my mother was a church musician, too.
Really?
But she didn't let me turn the pages on the bench. She was like, get off the bench. Go sit down and pray. You know, was that kind of stuff. Well, did you study organ?
I did, yes. Yeah, so my undergrad is in organ performance and sacred music from Duquesne University. And then my master's is a little bit different. It's it was a master's in music, history, and literature from Youngstown State. I focused on Polish music during the Cold War, which is my other passion. I know.
The Cold War or the...
Well, I should say, my family's from Poland, and so I've always felt a very strong connection with them. And so I'm very interested in the Solidarity Movement. Do you remember Lech Walesa?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, so that's the other, like, my one area of history that I really love to study and research.
Why do you think organ players are becoming less and less? Have you noticed that? That there's less?
Of course I do. I mean, I was the only female in my class at Duquesne University, I think. No, I mean, that's not true, but it felt like it at sometimes. But I think that the organ, first off, I mean, unfortunately, I think the organ is seen as an antiquated instrument. I think also it's kind of intimidating. You know, I mean, it can be intimidating for some. And I don't know if it represents a lot of forward-thinking worship in some ways. And people maybe associate it with it being old or backwards or something that's just not as present in the liturgy, which I disagree with. But I think it's partially that. I think it's also partially that, especially in some of the states like Texas and in the South, there really aren't, and correct me if I'm wrong, listeners, but from what I know, church organs just weren't necessarily built when those newer churches were built. And up north where I live, I think that's the case. I mean, they didn't become, in the post-Vatican II world, something that necessarily was the required item in a church. You know, I think pianos started coming in, which I use a piano, I play all the time. Other instruments, which engage others, come in. But I think that the organ is kind of a misunderstood instrument. You know, when I was early on in my career, I was in my mid-20s, and I had adult braces for the second time. So if you saw me, I look young, but imagine I had adult braces, so I looked even younger. And I was meeting with a couple to pick their wedding music. And they came up to me, and they said, "We're looking for Amanda." And I said, "Yeah, that's me." And they stopped and went, "Oh, I'm sorry, I didn't expect." And I said, "Were you expecting an 80-year-old named Rosemary?" And they laughed and said, "Yes, we kind of were." Mm-hmm. So I just think, unfortunately, it's an instrument that is not as understood. It's kind of misunderstood.
But the church there's somewhere in the church documents that talk about that organ is the primary instrument.
In the Vatican II documents, and I will admit, I've read them, but I can't quote where it is. But from what I know, is that originally in the first Vatican II documents, the organ was meant to support the congregational singing. And I believe the quote is that it had its pride in place as the primary the primary instrument for
kind of like it talks about Gregorian chant having pride in place.
That's correct.
Now, that gets misunderstood, right? That what that really means, because a lot of folks will say this is first, but that's not necessarily what that means, right? That pride in place.
Well, I think that touches on the style wars that I feel like we talk about all the time. But yes, I mean, to me, Gregorian chant is a style of music just like every other style that we use in the liturgy. We use traditional hymnody. We sing things from Bach. We sing things from the 70s. We sing things from the 80s. We sing things that you wrote 3 years ago. I mean, it's just, to me, it's a style of music that helps people engage. And I'm not here to totally dischant, but I think that every style engages people in different ways. I mean, there are some people that I know that just love Baroque music. That's great. I don't like Baroque music that much, but I know people that just really connect to it. I think it's the same thing with Gregorian chant. Unfortunately, I think this is where we kind of draw the line, that I'm of the philosophy, and I know many people may disagree with me, but I'm of the philosophy that by making sure that various styles are represented and represented well and executed well, not performed, but executed well in a liturgy, you have the chance to engage people in those styles that they feel the most connected with, while also then opening them up and opening that trust so that they can engage with the other styles that they may not originally feel connected with. But then they'll say, "Well, I like that, what they just did, so I'm going to give this other one a try too."
Yeah, the style wars is a problem because people get stuck in it, that it's their way or the highway.
Yes.
And that it appeals to them. The thing about chant And the organ. I do find that the organ in these big churches mm-hmm. for congregational singing, mm-hmm. what else can support that type of singing, you know, in those
point.
Big spaces?
Yeah.
But some of the newer churches that are built don't necessarily require such that. But there is something about the organ that one of our priests would say something like, this doesn't look like church. And I'm like, well, what does that mean? You ever heard that before?
Yeah.
Doesn't smell like church and all this kind of, you know, those kind of things. But there is something about the organ that I think that because it's hard to learn, mm-hmm. that it takes time and effort.
Mm-hmm.
And if a child's going to start playing the organ, but it becomes hard, and he goes to his parents and says, I want to quit. Mm-hmm. And the mother, instead of saying, you get in there and practice, you have mm-hmm. talent and skill, they're like,
right.
okay, you quit.
Well, here's something else, too, about the organ that I didn't realize until you just said that right now, too. I mean, you think about when you want to learn an instrument, right? A lot of the times it's when you're younger, right, typically at least. And you think about all the other instruments that a kid can learn, and most of them have some type of interaction with others. So the thing about the organ, too, you know, you think about when especially young people are learning an instrument for the first time, the organ is... I think a unique instrument in many ways. We've already talked about how it's challenging to learn. It requires so much coordination. But also, I think when people are young and they're adolescents, like so many other instruments give them the opportunity to interact and be a part of some type of ensemble. I mean, so many people are in choir, they're in orchestra, they're in band, they're even in guitar. They play in a band or they're in ensembles. But with the organ, its nature is... It's so anchored in literally, physically, it's anchored in the church. You can't move it. And so all of your practice, everything is so isolated. And I've never really thought about that until right now. But at least as you're learning an instrument as a teenager and as a young person, and you're learning it in a traditional sense, you're able to also have that social and relational aspect built in, which I do think matters to younger people. And so whenever you'd say, I want you to learn this organ, but you can only practice it in a church at 8:30 at night after choir is done in a dark, dusty church and there's mm-hmm. no one else around.
Yeah, that's true.
I've never really thought about that, but that's also possibly playing and play.
Which is, piano players, I think, are at a downward slide, too, just because it's hard. The learning curve is so hard.
Mm-hmm, right.
And I just remember my mother being adamant about getting in there and practicing, but yet I know... When my kids were taking piano, and they were like, I hate this. And then they just constantly, you're finally like, all right, just forget it. And they give up. And so, you know, we're not doing a good enough job, I think, of fostering
right.
children. And that's part of parenting, I think, as well.
Right.
I hate to say I did a bad job parenting, but I wish I would have stuck with it with them to push them sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
We don't want to push our kids.
Mm-hmm.
We don't want to force them to do anything.
Mm-hmm.
But,
right.
You know, there has to be a fine line there where sometimes you know what's good for them. Yeah.
I think too, at least with the piano, there are so many opportunities, I think, with recitals to at least have them engaged in some way. But there aren't as, I can't say, there are many organ studios that do, you know, organ student recitals. I will say in Pittsburgh, we have something called Pipe Organ Encounter, or POE,
yeah.
which gives them that opportunity, but that's not, that's not a given. And you have to know the right people to do it. That's the other thing, is I think organ becomes such a niche instrument, and you have to know very, very few set of people who are willing to teach. And it just becomes smaller and smaller in that funnel in order for students to have the opportunity to learn.
Yeah. So you live in Pittsburgh?
I do.
So you're a Steeler fan? Come on. Come on.
I'm not really into sports. Except the Olympics. I love the Olympics, but I'm really not.
But you live in Pittsburgh.
I know, but I...
Come on,
okay,
Pirates,
so,
Steelers,
okay,
Penguins.
I'm going to tell you something right now, John. Pittsburgh people don't go to the Pirates game for the sports. We go to the Pirates game for the pierogi race, okay?
Oh, yeah, that's right.
Where the people dress up in pierogi costumes and run, and we go for the nachos, and we go because we bought the... Oh, this is awful. I'm so sorry. I'm going to hate on Pittsburgh in this episode, but... We buy the tickets on Groupon, and we go for the nachos and the pierogi race, and we sing "Take Me Out to the Ball Game." That's why people, and it's on the river. It's so beautiful.
It is beautiful.
If you've ever been to PNC Park, it's a beautiful park.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, I love Pittsburgh, but the Pirates.
I know.
We go for many reasons.
Not
to
for them to win.
Baseball.
Unfortunately.
No, but we enjoy their sportsmanship. I will say this. I will say this. John, on my first date with my husband, we were sitting and we're talking, you know, you're Olive Garden on your first date, sitting talking, and he's talking about sports, actually. And he said, I love the Pittsburgh Penguins hockey.
Yeah.
Do you like them? And I said exactly what I just said. I said, oh, I don't like sports. And his face fell like somebody died. He went, what? Thankfully, we've gotten over that. And I've been to some games. But, yeah, I mean, I'm sorry. Steelers really, I'm sorry. I'm just not
okay.
a sports.
That's
I will say
okay.
this. If I'm a football person, it would actually be for Penn State because my husband went there, and Penn State was the place that I felt like had a lot of school spirit. I dated him while we were in college. So I probably am a Penn State person more than a Steelers person. But go ahead.
Well, this
finish
is, you know, this
statement.
Airs in Nashville, so it's Titan country. But there's a lot of Steeler fans everywhere you go.
Being
from West Virginia. You know,
Steeler
Pittsburgh
Nation
is
everywhere.
Everywhere.
It's every in every city.
Every
There's
city.
Steeler bars. Yeah. There's a Steeler bar in Rome. Did you know that?
No.
There's a Pittsburgh Steeler bar in Rome, Italy.
Well, I
yes.
might have to take a trip to Rome.
Just that's it. Just to go see the Steeler bar.
That's it. Not the Coliseum or the Pope.
Oh no, no. Just to see the Steelers bar.
Well, Amanda, is there a piece of music that has inspired you? You know, either an organ piece or any kind of song.
Oh man. Well, I mean, there are many. I think in terms of, I'll just say a hymn, like in some of my favorite hymns have been things that kind of always have stuck with me. Like some of my most important and most like indelible moments of formation that I really wanted to do this and be involved in this was from when I was probably like 8 or 9. And I remember specifically... It was a beautiful Cassavant organ, which, again, yes, I know, my organ side of me. But there's this beautiful church that I was going to Catholic school for, and they had a beautiful Cassavant organ. And they, the organist, who was spectacular, played Gift of Finest Wheat. And it was played so well, and it was just so such a beautiful in the space. The acoustics were beautiful, and it was just a wonderful space. That always has really stuck with me. I've always loved Gift of Finest Wheat. And recently I've started to go to different churches now that I'm no longer working full-time as music ministry. I'm at NPM. Everyone sings Gift of Finest Wheat. And everyone just, every parishioner I've seen, every church I go to, it must be the summer anthem. I don't know. But
we used it last week.
Yeah, see? I know, the church I went to last week did it too. But I watch people without hymnals right now because we're slowly bringing them back, but not fully yet. It doesn't matter. People sing the verses. People sing everything. They love that song. So that's probably one of my favorites.
Yeah, most people do, but we'll talk about that when we come back. So we'll play Gift of Finest Wheat.
That'd be great.
Yeah, so we're going to take a short break here with Amanda Bruce, who's head of marketing for the National Pastoral Musicians. And for the NPM conference here in New Orleans. And we come back, we're going to be joined with Berta Sabrio, who is the vice president of NPM. And we'll talk a little bit more about music and its effect on our lives and in the liturgy. So you listen to Living Real Radio on 94.5, brought to you by Closets by Design. We'll be right back. Here's Gift of Finest Wheat. Welcome back to Living Real Radio. I'm your host, John Angotti, here live in New Orleans at the Marriott Hotel at the NPM National Conference that has been going on for about 40 years. And joining Amanda is Berta Sabrio from Baltimore, who is the vice president of NPM. So, Berta, welcome. We're going to hand you the microphone and say hello.
Thank you, John. It's so nice to be here. Thank you, listeners.
It's the first time you've been on this show, right?
It is.
I mean,
don't know
we've
why.
We had Steve when he was the president.
I don't know why I'm always playing second fiddle.
What, you're going to be first violin right now.
Excellent.
So, Berta, what is your job as vice president?
So my job is really to do everything that nobody else wants to do.
Mm-hmm.
Really, programming and formation is really what I manage. And additionally, especially any convention planning, our Skill Builders program that we just started this year, any formation we do throughout the year, that kind of comes across my desk.
And you're a musician yourself, right?
I am.
And you're a player and a singer.
Absolutely. I was trained in voice with a secondary in keyboard.
Okay. Very good. And are you still playing at a church?
I am not, but I'm singing at a church.
Okay, that's good. So I want to go back to Gift of Finest Wheat. Last week at one of our younger cantors, so I did Gift of Finest Wheat at all the masses. But we have a 5 o'clock mass that's been going on for a while before even I got there. And so they do the praise and worship mass. And so this girl who sang, she's now 22 or 23, she was singing with the 8:30 group, and so I said, Gift of Finest Wheat, and she says, what's that? So even though that's something that we think that everybody should know, I do notice that those that have been brought up in the Life Teen contemporary worship don't know these old songs, you know. But there's something about, and we were talking about chant earlier too. I'm not a chant person. But what I've found is that chant does tie you into something different. You know, it was presented to me this past year that I never really thought about. But when we enter into Mass, this priest was telling me that he doesn't want to hear the music of today's sound. He said he wants to hear something that takes him to a different place. What do you think about that? Where, you know, chant, he says, takes you to a different place.
Well, sometimes it can take you to a bad place if the person who's singing is not very good or hasn't done the work, right? Chant really requires something that we're not doing much anymore. And it is such a sung, spoken language. And I think that if we treat it that way, the text really gets to shine. And I think as much as we love music and we love that melodic style, we love all the harmonies, frequently I think we really lose the importance of the text. And I think that chant really does bring that back. Also, we recently had a podcast where we talked about Taizé and its value. And one of the things that we were told, which was really revelatory for me, is that singers and assembly members, they want to know what's coming next. They want to know what to expect. And in Taizé, we know because we're repeating it over and over. And it really does elevate us to a different place of prayer. So I think that chant can do the same thing.
So praise and worship's like that too, though.
I agree.
You know, it's over and over, over and over. You know,
I agree.
And
I
that
agree.
Kind of thing. Why is music so important in the liturgy? You can both answer that. Why do you think music's so?
So I'll start. I was raised Southern Baptist, and my first fight in my life was over a hymnal. I clocked another little girl, and I got the hymnal, and then I got a spanking. So, you know, it was, for me, music was really important in the liturgy, obviously, because it was worth a beating. So there we have that. I do think, though, for people, I say this frequently, and I know other people do too, they don't leave humming the homily.
Right.
They leave humming what they've just heard. In the middle of the week, they hear something or they hum something, and it takes them back to that experience of church on Sunday. I think it lives in their heart. They're inspired by the words of the homily and the prayers, but I think that music makes a different touch. I think hearing people lift their voices together is one of the most beautiful sounds I've ever heard. I think when we haven't been able to sing together during COVID, that is what people are missing. They miss joining their voices, and I think our voices are going to be louder and louder and louder as we come back from this time.
Okay. Amanda?
I've shared already that I only just recently recently left full-time pastoral ministry, just on July 1st, so just about a month. And for the first time in my entire life, now that you listeners know that, I mean, I've kind of followed pastoral music for so long. For the first time in my entire life, I'm now attending churches as a pew dweller, as a congregant. And I'm going with my husband, and we're, to be honest, we're going all over. We're just trying to see what...
Roman Catholics.
Yeah, we're Roman Catholics, exactly.
That's right.
Yeah. And I'm noticing some things. One of the things that I know many people depend on for the Catholic Mass is that so much of it is so unchanging. The core of it, no matter where you go, doesn't change. And so the things that really do change and reflect the community and reflect the atmosphere that every parish creates is the welcoming nature of the community, the pastor or the priest, and how they engage the community, and the music and how it engages the community. And it's been very... it's been very telling to experience all these different parishes and see how that's lived out. And I got to tell you, I mean, music can breathe such life into the text of a reading or the homily and the entire experience. It really is one of the things that can be changed in a liturgy that is not as much changing. And I'll be honest, when it's not as engaging, it can be draining. I mean, it really makes such a difference in a liturgical experience for someone sitting in the pew, because I think we as pastoral ministers forget, you know, we're so ingrained, we're so entrenched in all of this. This is what we do. It's our language. It's what we do every day. But to most people, they come for an hour on a Sunday. That's it. and they experience things differently. They don't experience the depth that we do. We don't sit, we don't, you know, they don't know the chord progression of the summons off by heart. Like they just know what they experience for 1 hour, one time a week. And music can help carry it out the doors. It can help anchor the words that they hear. It helps continue the conversation, and it helps to connect them with that church in a way that no spoken word can. I just got off the call with a session right now, and they said that, you know, musicals in particular are so compelling, because if Julie Andrews ran up into the hill in Salzburg and said, "The hills are alive with the sound of music," it does not have the same impact. Music deepens the human experience in a way that nothing else does, and music helps deepen that experience in the Mass.
Music inside the church versus in the Catholic Church versus other denominations. Why is our music different? Why, you know, we don't do our music isn't heard on a radio. It's not radio worthy, or it's not looked at as something that you would hear on the radio. You know what I'm saying, right? But yet people, so now we have these 5 o'clock, we have these, you know, jamming masses, which I'm a part of too as well. Why do you think that people want to hear that? And like, I have certain music directors who will pick no Catholic song, will only pick praise and worship tunes, because he says they're written better. Or they're, you know, it's the today's sound or that kind of nature. But there's something different about Catholic music that's specific for the liturgy, even in the way it's written, right?
So different from
the Protestants. Yeah, why is our music so different than you know, other denominational stuff that's, you know, praise and worship worthy or things you hear on the radio?
Do you want me to start this one then? Okay. I mean, I think it ties back to what I just said. I mean, so much of our Catholic ritual, so much of our Catholic faith is intentional. There's nothing in the Catholic liturgy that we don't do without intention. There's a depth of meaning in everything that's done. There's symbols and so much profound depth in everything we're doing. And I think that ties along to our music. One of the things I take concern of when it comes to implementing music from, I wouldn't even say Protestant, to be honest. I would almost even say non-denominational.
Yeah.
Music that is our local radio station is called K-Love, like our local K-Love, is that personally for me, I have to think about the theology behind the text of the songs that I'm picking. Why did I choose this song for the prep of gifts? Personally, I sometimes struggle to see the theology behind some of the text for the more non-denominational type of radio songs that are contemporary Christian that are used. And I also think, too, that, and this is getting a little bit deeper into the weeds, but I think that most Catholic music, too, expresses a depth of vocal range where in an attempt to encourage people to sing more contemporary Christian music, it's in a very limited range so that it's easy to sing text-wise, it's easy to sing melodic-wise, it's easy to sing range-wise. And I do think that most pew dwellers, most congregants get their own musical education, whether they realize it or not, by singing something like I Am the Bread of Life, where you go from a low A flat to a high E flat and you express that vocal range. I do think that there is actually a physical benefit to a song like that. I can't necessarily say that something from Hillsong would do the same. It seems to stay in that same middle range.
Yeah. Go ahead, Berna.
Again, I think that for all of us in music ministry, part of the real trick is how do you keep what you need to from tradition and determine what you need to continue into the future, which becomes the new tradition, right? What do we need to keep? And how do we do that? And what does speak to people? I agree with you, John. I think it's always sad that they leave Hellman, the songs that we hear at church, but then they never hear them again during the week because they are listening to K-Love or another type of station where they're hearing beautiful music that's kind of raising up for the week.
Right.
That's how I feel when I listen to that to K-Love as well,
right,
that I'm really feeling like my heart is lifted, even going to something I don't want to go to. Isn't it unfortunate that we can't find something similar for our Catholic listeners and find a really good mix and a really good blend of that traditional, contemporary. I just always hate the word contemporary because I think it should all be contemporary.
Yeah.
Contemporary means of the day, right? It's current. Contemporary means us, how we live our life. And if we think of traditional hymns and contemporary music and praise and worship, it's all music.
Yeah.
So what is speaking to us and how do we, I think that a lot of contemporary artists are writing music in that middle range because it's less intimidating for the person that's never had any training. But again, that purpose of On Eagle's Wings, that is crazy, crazy leap.
Yeah.
And they people sing it like it's their lives depend on it. I mean, they are really into it.
Actually, I have a real quick thing about On Eagle's Wings, if that's okay.
Absolutely.
So I once did a funeral with a guest vocalist who was not Catholic. They were Protestant, and they were not familiar with On Eagle's Wings. And I played the first chord, right, on that first verse, where you're playing like a G chord, and then you have a C sharp, so it's not even in the chord.
Yeah.
And I played it, and the person said, "Do Catholics actually sing this?" And I said, "Yeah." And they said, "They can find that note?" I said, "Yes, they really can." Yeah, so it's true. There's a huge gap. And one more thing about Eagle's Wings, too, not to stay on Eagle's Wings, but I had a friend who was graveside, which is not the funny part of the story, but she was singing On Eagle's Wings at a graveside, and she started too low in On Eagle's Wings on that first note. And by the end of the refrain, she was like, "And I will raise you up." See, it's a huge range.
Uh-huh. That C sharp on there, that sharp 11.
Yeah, that's
what
right.
It could be. If you know, it's a sharp 4, but you could make it
right,
stretch it
right.
out. Yeah, right. But those songs, the theology in those songs are so deep. A lot of our music, I find the poetry and the text sometimes is, for a lot of people, unless you sit with the song and read the text and internalize it, but when you're just flying by with a hymn and you got all these words, are people getting that? You know, have we written stuff so thick that, I mean, it might be memorable, but the words are not sustainable, you know, because it's so hard, or you're only hearing it once, and then you don't hear it again for maybe another 8 weeks, or, you know, of that nature. So people will say sometimes at Mass to me, can you play some of those Catholic songs, you know?
Yeah.
And when you really look at what the Catholic songs are, there really hasn't been much going since. I mean, there's the old stuff and there's old chant, but only in the last, I don't know, 50 years do we have a whole plethora of music that would be Catholic. I don't know. Am I missing? You know, there's the Let All the Mortal Fleshes, and I don't know how old that tone is old, you know, so the chant mm-hmm. tones are old.
Mm-hmm.
But our specific music that belongs to us.
Mm-hmm.
What are some of those songs? Because I can't, you know, I've tried to rack my Holy God. And
well, I once had a professor in college that said, "Holy God, we praise thy name," was the Catholic national anthem.
Yeah.
So maybe that's not a good example. But I really do think the Second Vatican Council changed all of that. I think that might have been like a demarcating line, because the guidelines from which music was used in Catholic liturgy changed. I mean, participation was not encouraged pre-Vatican II.
Yeah.
It was only encouraged after 1968. And so there was this huge pendulum swing. You want to talk about contemporary music. I mean, those first folk masses in 1969, wow, were they folky. I mean, they were Peter, Paul, and Mary right there. Exactly. Yeah,
not
exactly.
Mary, Jesus, and Joseph, but Peter, Paul, and Mary.
Yeah, and so that pendulum swung because we were trying to find that middle ground. And so I do think that the Second Vatican Council kind of created that opening space for repertoire in the specific Catholic faith that hadn't been there previously. And I think that might have been the first place to kind of like define what Catholic music was.
Well, maybe we're still evolving. What do you think? I think we're still coming. The best music is yet to come. What do you think?
Well, I don't know how I feel about that, because I think that there's a lot of really good music.
Yeah, right.
I think what we have to do to have the best worship is to pick well and to choose based on text and to choose based on things that are going to touch people's heart. But I agree with you, John. I do think that there is a lot of incredible inspired music coming out, especially some of our younger composers.
Mm-hmm.
And just people that are kind of feeling free. You know, they're feeling more free about what they're writing for the church and what they're saying to people.
Yeah.
They're not as constrained by the meter of the hymn.
What's one of those songs you like?
Oh, I love Sarah Kroger. I love Belovedness. It's a beautiful piece.
Belovedness. Yes, I just heard that the other day.
Speaks so well, I think, to every one of us.
Yeah.
And especially, I think, we feel so unworthy. And I think having that idea of our worth and that nobody judges us as harshly as we do, and God doesn't judge us at all.
Yeah. That's a beautiful song. So here's Belovedness by Sarah Kroger. You're listening to Living Real Radio on Hippie Radio 94.5. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Living Real Radio. I'm your host, John Angotti, flying solo here in New Orleans at the NPM conference. I'm here with Amanda Bruce and Berta Sabrio, who is the vice president. Amanda's the director of marketing. We got a new president in Jennifer, who's running around here somewhere. We love Jennifer. Yeah, there's something that, though, you have to be a certain height to be the vice president or president of.
Yeah, but you can be very tall to
be
the marketing
director.
You can be very tall
like to be the marketing
director. Yeah, exactly.
That's right. That's right. So, Berta, as the conference is, you know, we gathered, where do we go from here?
You know, NPM is so interesting. I've been a member for 30 years, since my infancy. And I think that for me, it was such a formational place to go. And I've heard for years and years, oh, we're going to the NPM. We're going to the NPM. And that meant they were coming to the convention.
Yeah.
And we have been identified with this convention, which is why it was so important for us to be virtual last year, to really reach out and in a world where we knew nothing about how to do that, create something that was really successful. And this year to be among the first in our industry to do a hybrid, which has also been challenging, but so rewarding. NPM has become so much more than just a convention. We have multiple media now to come to you all week long. Ministry Monday, which Amanda hosts. Additionally, we have a Wednesday concert series. We have a Thursday Thoughts at 3. Really, words of inspiration that we really are hoping touch people all week long, or that they can come back later and listen to. We've also started intense formation throughout the year, whether they're virtual workshops, retreats, our Essentials of Catholic Liturgy that we're in partnership with LTP on. We're really trying to be more than just a convention.
How can somebody who's not a musician, who's listening, who wants to know more about the faith, and wants to know more about their whatever, can they plug into NPM?
Absolutely. We just have started. We've changed our membership tiers a little bit. So while we do still have our premium membership, which is really designed for that music director who's working full-time in a church, working in multiple venues as far as types of cantors and choirs that they're working with, we have our standard membership, which is that maybe part-time musician that wants to learn more about what they're doing. And I'm really excited about our basic membership, which is really designed for exactly who you just talked about, John, or a choir member, a cantor, a lector, a Eucharistic minister, deacon, pastor. There's lots of things to learn about ministry and what we're offering. And we really feel that at that basic level, it's incredibly accessible to anybody that wants to learn more about their faith and about ministry and liturgy.
Well, that's a beautiful thing. So, you know, anybody in the pew who's, you know, looking for something, I don't think people realize that they could be a part of that, because it just seems like it's musicians only. Because of the title and all that, basically it is, you know, 99.9% musicians. But, you know, I think people struggle with their own faith and need a resource that they can go to and click to a site and look at something on music or look at something on, and you all offer that, right?
We do. I think also for people to be able to realize that they can speak the same language that we do, even if they don't read music. Or we have a workshop that we're running this fall that is actually the fundamentals of music theory. So for that person that has been dying to learn to speak this language, it's $50 for 4 sessions, I think. Incredibly affordable, great way for anybody, not just a musician, to learn this language that seems so elusive and to understand that they can learn to read it.
Okay, great. So anybody out there interested in knowing more about the Catholic Church, just in music in general, layperson, doesn't have to, you don't even have to be Catholic, you know, so anybody can join the organization. What are the goals? What do you foresee in the next year and beyond?
So I think in the next year, we're really going to be working on a new series that we've put out, which is Skill Builders. We just hosted our first one, our premiere in Reno at the beginning of July, because why wouldn't you host two major events in the same month?
Yeah, because
it wasn't a challenge enough to do a hybrid. And the goal of that is actually to work with local musicians who really want to hone their skills. Here, I think at the convention in our other formation, we're really working to hone their formation, their spiritual lives, how they do what they do. In Skill Builders, we're really helping them build a specific skill. They have to pick one track. So if they come in to sing, that's what they're working on for the 3 days that they're there. They're a guitarist, same thing. So to really be able to go among the people and to be diocesan-wide and drivable for people to come and spend some time with us and really work on building their chops and also to learn more about the liturgy, because that's a major component in that program.
Well, that is good news. At St. Philip, we have St. Philip Art and Liturgy Institute that we started a couple years ago. I wonder if we need to talk.
We'd love to come to Nashville.
Part of, because it would be great to see other churches and other parishes. And any music directors, anybody's listening, NPM is a great place that we all can join to be a part of, because there's nothing that we have that unites us. And I'm not, you know, it's not a union per se, because, you know, you can't go get our salaries higher and stuff like that. But you can be a place where we all unite. To praise and to pray and to prepare ourselves for what we have to do as musicians and liturgists to bring an encounter to the people, you know.
I agree. And one of the things that I think is so interesting, every time we have a convention and on-site, one of the things that we hear from our hotels, convention centers, any place that we gather, is how nice our people are, how nice they are, how kind they are, how much they enjoy being together. They love hearing the music. They love experiencing the prayer. Yeah. So we're even reaching out further than us, just even in our conventions and our programming.
Yeah, that's great. So what's something we can close with? Give us a closing song, Berta, Amanda.
You know, I know that it's very typical, but one of my very favorite songs is How Can I Keep From Singing? Because I think as long as we can keep doing that, that was how I felt during COVID, was, how can I get to sing again? And to have that melody, those words that are so rich, that's, I think, a great way for us to close, John.
Tonight in our concert, I'm using How Can I Keep From Singing as the prayer piece. So that's funny that you said that song. So that's what we're going to use.
Great.
So thank you guys for being on here. Good luck with NPM. We'll be supporters of it. And anybody out there listening, they can go to npm.org to find out all the information and also see maybe some of the stuff from the conference that happened this week.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So here is How Can I Keep From Singing. You're listening to Living Real Radio on Hippie Radio 94.5. Go out and smile at somebody. Have a great day. God bless.
You've been listening to Living Real Radio, real issues in real time, with your host, John Angotti, Greg Walton, and Julianne Staley. Be sure to tune in every week at 8 a.m. to Living Real Radio. Living Real Radio is sponsored by Closets by Design. Imagine your home totally organized by Closets by Design. Call them today to schedule your appointment at 615-261-8700. That's 615-261-8700.